Yeah, it's
feeling the pressure now, guys. Jesus, yeah, I'm the one who's now got to do an interview.
You've got your notes.
Tips.
We'll mark you out of 10 at the end.
Oh, God. Hello and welcome to another episode of But Why, the podcast that's all about digging into big questions and tricky topics via honest conversations. This week, we're going to be looking at trauma. It's actually hilarious that I said that in a sing-songy voice when trauma is not that. And I'm going to be talking to Dr. Sarah Woodhouse. Sarah is a research psychologist, trauma specialist, author, coach, and creator of the Freedom Process. Sarah researched trauma as an academic, funded by the Medical Research Council for 11 years. She still researches trauma today, but now uses her work to create cutting-edge resources to help people heal. Her book, You're Not Broken, I always feel obliged to kind of put this on camera now, but that's only useful if you're watching the video, but Her book, You're Not Broken, Break Free from Trauma and Reclaim Your Life is a gentle but useful guide to doing just that. And more importantly, Sarah and I both went to school together. I think the last time we saw each other was around about the year 2000. And excitingly or controversially, Sarah went on to marry a guy from the boys' school over the road. So that for when I say her surname, that is extremely loaded for me because I know her husband. And now you're a legit doctor. I think Miss Wainwright and the other teachers would be
Miss Wainwright.
She was terrifying, wasn't she?
Oh, God, I'd forgotten.
She was terrifying.
Oh, I was coming out in cold sweats.
Yeah.
She was terrifying, yeah. She was completely terrifying.
But she'd be very proud of you, I think. You're a doctor.
I think so. Who knows? She never looked that happy to me.
No, but at the time at school, the only person they were kind of reeling out as the alumni from the hire is Linda Bellingham, who is the actress in the the OXO adverts.
Oh, so good. Yeah.
I could go off on a massive tangent about our school, but it's kind of interesting to me that researching you and thinking about the idea of actually, you know what, before I get into that, I'm going to do my lighthearted question. So we're going to go straight deep. How are you really? What star sign are you? And what's your favourite crisp?
Oh, such a good question. How am I really? I am really okay. Great. I really am. It's been a really bumpy few years in our house, in our family, but I'm okay. We moved back to the UK about 6 months ago from Australia.
How long were you in Australia for?
It was a complete relief to be back. We were there for 3 years and it was really tough.
Really?
It was. I feel like I can be more, the more I'm back, the more open I am about just how difficult it was. For me, and therefore for the kids, because of course I'm the one trying to shepherd them through this experience. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was a bit tough, but now I'm okay. I'm happy to be home. I'm enjoying the English spring. Oh,
how did you end up in Australia?
Brexit.
Ah,
yeah, just left. Just it's funny. Well, you know Neil, my husband. It's so weird that you know him. I'm very political. He's not. I study politics. I work for the Lib Dems for a little while. He's not particularly political, but Brexit really got him. I remember him like sobbing in front of the TV when it happened.
Wow.
And at the same time, a friend of ours who you also know had just moved to LA, and I think because she'd done it, we both thought, oh, it's all right. You can just move abroad with 3 kids. It's not that hard. And then it transpired. It actually is quite hard. It also transpired that I have a trauma history, and which I knew, of course I knew. And what became very clear is that if you have a trauma history, it's what I'd done is work very, very hard to establish a secure base and a secure attachment at home. So I had my routine, I had my friends, I had my home, you know, just these really important things. And because I felt so empowered and I was in such a good space, I thought, yes, sod it, let's go to Australia. And of course, it was really hard. So I am so happy to be back. Yeah.
Wow. What a thing to have done. But you know what? I've got so many different things to say, but my husband had a business 7 years ago that went terribly wrong, you know, upended us, got us in financial trouble, challenged our marriage, et cetera, et cetera. And actually, we were just about at a point in our lives where we could deal with that kind of, and at least all the things we learned from that very traumatic experience have helped shape us in the next chapter, I suppose. Sometimes you have to go to quite dark places, don't you, to learn.
Yeah, it's just so true. My daughter said to me yesterday, she's having a bit of a tricky time at school, and I said, everything's always all right. And she wailed, it's not ever. And I was like, no, honestly, the weirdest thing about life is that it's always okay. It is. And that's been my experience. And it's mad that I believe that. Of course I do. I hope you can feel that as you read the book. But my experience of life is that no matter how dark it gets, somehow it's always okay. Weird.
I've got
so weird.
A sign that I had made which says everything will be okay. Yeah. And it always is. It always is.
It's so weird, isn't it?
Yeah. And my biggest learning, I think, from the last couple of years has been to try and stop not wasting energy, but I'm prone to putting a lot of energy into being quite anxious and into controlling as a coping strategy. And so often those things I've poured all that energy into have never come to anything. So I'm really trying to go, mull this thing over, think about it, but don't do that like deep spiral of rumination, because chances are by next week that thing that you were wrangling is changed or evaporated, and it's just a waste of time.
It's a total waste of time. And I can wax lyrical about this, because really when I dive into that space, so when I ruminate and I worry, basically it means I've been triggered. It means I've gone into it. I'm afraid. So what I need to do is just take a beat and give myself a cuddle and help myself feel safe, right? Regulate my nervous system, all that stuff. It's taken me so many years to realize that, because all I really need to do in life to be happy is let go and go with the flow and really just relax as much as you can, let go of control and just flow with it all.
Yeah.
You know, and let go of the outcome. But I forget that on a daily basis.
Well, always. So that was what I was going to ask you when I was preparing for this and reading a little bit about your trauma history and thinking about mine. It's quite sad and weird and interesting that at the time when we last knew each other, we were probably deeply experiencing those traumatic things. And that's quite a crazy thing about that chapter of teenage years at school. You're kind of going through life, but there are so many like entrenched things beginning to be formed and things that you believe about yourself and patterns with your family. Yeah, and it's quite bizarre now for us to then meet up however many years later, both hopefully having done a lot of work to try and heal some of that.
Yeah, it is odd, isn't it? It's funny even thinking back to that time, because I think teenage years are just bizarre, aren't they? There's an intensity to them, but also a lack of authenticity somehow, because you just don't, well, not everyone. And obviously we're trying to raise our kids in a different way to give them a language to communicate about how they're feeling. But I think for so many of us, it's internalized. Mm. So you look back on this in just crazy, crazy intense time of trauma and maladaptive coping and all this stuff. And at the same time, there's almost a silence around it. I don't know about you, but I wasn't really communicating with anyone.
Not at all.
Yeah.
And I think that will have changed generationally, because I don't think we had the language. Yeah, I don't think I even understood how to describe feeling anxious or worried until quite a lot later. And you know, there is all this kind of, we were quite similar at school, like doing gentle rebellion, pushing the boundaries, but not really being super naughty, because
that's exactly it. Yeah.
But you know, for me to even do that, because I'm definitely an inherent kind of good girl, someone should have said, are you okay? Because I really wasn't. And I'm sure in every classroom there was lots of us going through similar things.
Oh, so many. And I'm sure if you ask my parents, that would be their biggest regret. Of course they would have said, are you all right, darling, how was school? But they'd have been met with a fine. It was fine. And I think my mum now talks, I don't think she would mind me saying this, but does talk a lot about her instinct and how now we're kind of living in this version of motherhood where we are all being encouraged to listen to and trust our instincts. But that just wasn't a language they used then. So she'll say, you know, I had an instinct, but it just wasn't a thing then. No. It was just crash on, hope for the best. I mean, all she ever used to say to me was have a hot bath and a cup of tea, which, let's be honest, is fantastic advice, but is not a cure-all for everything.
No, exactly. I mean, it is actually bizarrely super grounding and exactly in the short term what you should be doing.
That's it.
Do you think that the
Are you comfortable saying anything more about the things that you've recovered from or not?
Oh, completely comfortable. Good. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you want to say what it is that we're kind of dancing around? It's eating disorder, kind of. Yeah, an eating disorder.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, well, I have a history of trauma. So, and for that, for me, that looks like relational trauma. So primarily it was molestation when I was young. And I have, again, it's that silence, you know, reacting and having such a strong reaction to it internally, but not telling anyone. And then going to this huge school, I just went into freefall. You know, the bulimia started almost as soon as I got there.
Really?
I couldn't cope. And that's what I, you know, this is what I work in now is helping people understand that if you have a relational trauma, so if the trauma happened within the context of a relationship, which so much childhood trauma is, right? Mm-hmm. If you think about what's going on in the home, family dysfunction, all of that kind of stuff, it's often relational. So the outcome of that is that you find relationships really, really, really hard. So I thought I was going mad. I just can't do this. I can't make friends. I don't get it. I just had overwhelming anxiety. Even at the thought of needing to be friends with someone and just how do I do it? I don't understand how I do it. And of course, you know, as I've got older, I've understood what that's about and what mechanisms were going on. But as we've said, you know, it wasn't the time when you spoke about how you felt, and it certainly wasn't a time for me when I was able to find the language to say what had happened. So I spiraled. I don't know if that even sums it up. It started with bulimia. Quickly, I was very, very anorexic by the age of about 19. And then a lot of the stuff that comes along with that. So very dysfunctional drinking, very dysfunctional relationships, you know, romantic relationships, I mean, panic attacks. It just wasn't pretty. It really wasn't. And then interestingly, we met Neil at Glastonbury. He was with Johnny Hurd. Do you remember Johnny Hurd?
Yeah.
They were at Glastonbury together and I walked past, I think he was charging his phone. And that was almost the beginning of me moving out of it because I met someone I felt safe with. Because I suppose in part because there was a history there, because at school Neil and I had been really good mates, really, really genuinely good. I mean, everyone was friends with Neil. I don't know if you remember that, but we were good friends. And I think I saw him. So it was the first time I'd had a romantic relationship where I knew someone's history. I could picture him at 11 getting on the bus. And it just, there was a safety to it that I hadn't experienced with any other men. And that was probably the beginning of me getting well, because I wanted to be well, to have kids as much as anything. You know, that's the truth. I obviously did, I knew that I couldn't pass on my dysfunction. So that was the catalyst.
And it's so strange for me sitting here as a kind of, you know, we were in and around the same circles. And you, for me, I'm crying because this is what I do. I just look back at all those times, and you, for me, would have been one of the people that I saw as being super popular and cool and having a great time, and it just shows the madness of it, doesn't it?
It does just show the madness of it.
And I'm like in my mind going around various situations, you know, house parties, hanging out at the bus park, and just thinking, well, what was the internal dialogue for all those people? And this kind of feeling that we all could have helped one another if we'd even have had the language to do it. But we were young.
We were young, exactly. And I don't know about you, but I, especially given what I work in now, I find it really difficult to say this because in the space that I work in, because of course, so many of us, you know, and actually so many women and men far worse than me have had really very severe, terrifying life experiences. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, I always come back to a space where I just feel like everything happens for a reason. If you can, as I said before, go with the flow. I mean, I am here talking to you because of what's happened to me. Mm. You know, I've written my book because of what's happened to me. So although I wouldn't wish it on anyone, and I certainly wouldn't go back and say, yes, please, I'll choose that again, I can absolutely see that my life has unfolded in a way that has allowed me to learn and grow from these horrible things and from my mistakes.
I think you made an important point, though, which I did want to touch on, is
like misunderstandings about what we mean about trauma, because of course you have these big catastrophic life events that we can easily put into a trauma box, but as we all know, it's so often the much smaller, I think you call it, do you call it small T traumas? Where
I call it other T. You do. Other people call them small tree, yeah. T, but I think it's I don't know, just a bit, well, it minimises it, doesn't it, because they're not small at all.
No, and you know, so often when you are in a trauma response, but when things happen, you're like, why can't I deal with this? You know, I see friends dealing with much bigger things, or I've dealt with much bigger things, but this bump in the road is the one that has absolutely triggered me. So, yeah, can you talk a bit about the misunderstandings about what we mean, what we mean when we say trauma?
Yeah, so when we say trauma, I think what's happened is that trauma, the word trauma, has been kind of synonymous and kind of glooped together with PTSD. So when we think PTSD, and we've got that vision of the veteran returning from Afghanistan, you know, with severe PTSD, they've kind of moved together. They're actually not the same thing. PTSD is an outcome of trauma, but trauma itself is a reaction that happens in the moment to any experience that makes us feel, well, first of all, threatened. So we'll perceive a threat. Of course, that can be within a relationship, right? If you jump back into the childhood context, that could be dad's always shouting, or mum's never here, or mum and dad are getting divorced. It could, you know, that all that's happening is we're perceiving a threat, and that's really subjective. That's such a subjective experience. What feels like a threat to me may not feel like a threat to you, and vice versa. Yeah. So we perceive a threat, and then the threat, we kind of do the maths, and we decide subconsciously that we don't have the resources available to deal with that threat, i.e. we're really overwhelmed and we feel really out of control. So it's those three things pulling together. And the reason I use those terms is because they're really human. Mm. And I think we can all understand how it feels, but really what's going on is our survival mechanism is triggered in a way that means it doesn't resolve. So we go up into fight, flight, freeze, fawn, collapse, or you know, up or down. Mm. And what needs to happen is that the cycle is completed. So we'll go up or we'll go down, and then we come back to the middle space where our system can regulate. That is regulation. Mm. But what happens is, because it felt so big and so overwhelming, we can't do that. So we kind of stay stuck in the response.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
which is a relatable, and then from what I was hearing, even in relation to your story, is things can become challenging when you layer stuff on top of that. So in your case, you added in an eating disorder, or because in the ways we find to try and mask or cope with that response, end up shaping things even further.
Yeah, exactly, and linked to that, traumas kind of stack up on top of each other, because once you've had one, you're in the zone. Mm. You're hypervigilant. You've moved into this threat perception that is going to pick up on more threats. You're going to notice more things potentially being wrong, things that could harm you, things that could hurt you within relationships or not. And then of course you're going to dive back into the response. So it's almost like you just go up, 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 up. And people, I spend so long talking to men and women who have had an adult trauma, and who contact me and say, there was absolutely nothing wrong with my childhood. They're, you know, I had this standalone experience. And as a researcher, I can say that can happen, but it's really, really rare.
Really?
Usually if there's an adult trauma, so if we have a traumatic reaction to something in adulthood, usually it means that there was an experience beforehand
that has shaped that
exactly, that kind of that changed almost the way that your system operated. Mm-hmm. You know, your nervous system when you were younger would have organized itself to protect you, and the hypervigilance is about that, the avoiding your feelings is about that, avoiding other people, going inwards. These are all protective, that they link right back to the nervous system and to that response. They're all about protecting us. So when that happens and you've gone into that space, you're just much more likely to then go on and have a trauma later in life.
Interesting. And the difficult thing is, because this happens at such a like foundational part of your life, it's difficult. And I definitely know when my anxiety spiraled to a point, to know where my personality was and traits that are me and where the anxiety disorder was, because you begin to inhabit them so much, don't you? Or they inhabit you.
Yeah. It's awful. I was reading something yesterday actually about how anxiety, it's really helpful if we all consider anxiety to be an unresolved or an unfinished fight, flight, freeze response. Mm-hmm. And was kind of explaining how that can be helpful. Anyway, that's kind of by the by. But I agree that so a key part of what I do with women, I predominantly work with women, is to help them differentiate, so separate from the reaction. Mm-hmm. And it's all about creating that space. So often we've been inhabiting this world where we think, I am an anxious person. Or I am this, I am that. And actually the healing starts as you can help them stand back and observe.
Yeah.
It's amazing and it's so powerful. It really is. I've got gooses as I talk about it, because as soon as people can do that, when they've pulled back into their kind of adult self, you know, their core self, and they can actually watch, as soon as that separation happens, I know that they are developing a separate sense of self to the trauma, mm-hmm. and that they're on the road to recovery, essentially.
And then they can employ, I guess it is kind of the rational mind, the adult mind, who can pick things apart rather than, yeah, being in a response situation.
Exactly. That's exactly how I view it, is what I'm constantly trying to do is show people that everything their experience is coming from the subconscious. It's a younger version of themselves. And their adult self is over here. It's still here. We just need to find ways to reconnect to it. Yeah.
And it's interesting, because actually often for me, part of the process is just sorting it through in my head, speaking it out loud. And that is, for me, I think one of my trauma responses is to feel like, when I respond to trauma, when I feel dismissed or unheard, that is my kind of flashpoint. So actually all it takes for me sometimes is someone to say, oh yeah, I'm hearing what you're saying, whether it's, you know, founded in reality or not is kind of irrelevant. It's just being heard. But it is a process of having to pick through things, isn't it?
It is. And I just love that you've got that insight about yourself, because if we could all have that, everything would be better, right? Mm. All our relationships would be better. And I think in a parenting context, I'm sure you've talked about that a lot on this podcast, but I would say anyone listening, is that is just such a great thing to remember. Mm. You know, trauma often springs from, in a childhood context, it springs from us feeling unseen, unheard, unacknowledged. Mm. So our feelings aren't validated. And it leads to this, essentially, it leads to a trauma response and a shame-based sense of self, because we're kind of looking inwards. Mm. So to any parents listening, you know, I sound like a parrot when I talk to my kids sometimes, because I'm just constantly mirroring what they say. Okay, I hear you. You feel, you know, I may not agree with it. I might think it's, you know, but it's always just reflecting back to them so that they feel seen.
Mm. Yeah, that's a really important thing I think I learned, I think, from Anna May, that about, you know, I understand why you want a magazine in the supermarket. I understand why you feel like you want it. What isn't okay is you then kicking me because you can't have it. But you know that you've got to try and break up these things, haven't you? Because
you do.
Yeah, I'm really, you know, I've recently had kids' birthdays and one sibling being so envious of the other, and you can't say to them you can't feel envious. We actually all completely relate to watching your sibling get a really good present, but what isn't okay is to snatch it. And I think beginning to separate feelings and behaviors out is really helpful.
Oh, totally. And it links so highly to shame, doesn't it? Just if we don't, all they're hearing is that their natural impulse and instinct, i.e. them, this thing that's kind of pulling out of them, pushing out of them, is wrong. So you have to always connect, don't you, to connect to that, to reassure them almost that thing that you're feeling is completely human. I make up, don't tell my kids this, but I'm constantly making up stories about, so that they can feel my connection to them.
Really?
So in the moment, it's not like I make up stories, but I'll say, I totally remember that feeling. Mm. You know, I remember feeling so envious on my brother's birthday or whatever it might be. And you can see just the relief. Oh, thank God. I'm not, you know, I'm not wrong. I'm not bad.
Yeah, it's so interesting because, you know, if you consider, I've considered myself pretty tuned into my feelings, and which I'm assuming I always was. But if you're told that you shouldn't be feeling things, whether they're positives, negatives, it's a very confusing thing because it's like, but I am feeling it, whether I should, it should show up in the way it does. And then, as you say, if you begin to invalidate that, when something genuinely bad happens and you feel threatened or scared, you're then questioning those responses as well.
Totally. Totally. I find it so interesting. I think we're diving off trauma now. Yeah. One thing, I've worked with this incredible somatic therapist, and she does a lot of work with families mm-hmm. and helping parents. And we've worked with my shame and helped me kind of move through it. And then we had amazing conversations about how our children, my kids might feel it or experience it. And she got me to play around with saying, I love you so much when, I don't know if you've done this.
No.
I love you so much when they make a mistake. Mm. So going to bed and saying, so I said to my daughter, she got kicked out of music yesterday. And as she went to bed, I said, oh, I love every single part of you. I love you so much when you're kicked out of music. And you just saw this like, oh, because you do. I love her so much when she's kicked out of music. I'd really like it if she wasn't kicked out of music again. But I love that, you know, I love that she was so overwhelmed and got told off, and we've all been there. And I love that.
Yeah, it's
and
really gorgeous.
I enjoy playing around with it. Yeah.
It's really gorgeous. And it stops that kind of sitting in their bodies, doesn't it, as they go to bed that night, that guilt. And, you know, what we'd want to do is raise kids who know where the lines are on what is appropriate behaviour, but not that then layer on this shame and self-loathing. And that's where it begins it is all related to trauma though, isn't it? I think going back to the different kinds of trauma, I think for me, when I was finding myself stuck with anxiety and feeling like, particularly for me, it was that I couldn't move past my parents' divorce, I kept on saying to myself, come on, you're 40. Why is what happened to you when you're 12 still bothering you? And feeling like I didn't deserve to seek help about it because it wasn't as bad as what had happened to other people, and therefore I should be able to cope with it. And then the problem is these things just stay with you.
That's exactly it. And I think I'm really tempted to do some kind of study on everyone that I see, because not obviously including names, but just the stats, because I would say that 100% of the women that come to see me say, but it wasn't that bad. And that is totally irrespective of what they've experienced. Mm. So it's incredible. So what that has taught me is that response is not about the thing. Mm. It's about, you know, a key part of trauma is denying it and minimizing it. It's how we've stayed safe and protected ourselves for years. So to suddenly turn that around and say, actually, I don't think that was okay. Mm. And I don't think I was all right. That step is huge. Mm-hmm. But isn't it so fascinating, because their instinct has got them to me. So their instinct, they know they're not okay.
Yeah.
So they've crossed that line. But still, I mean, I have one client and I would say a year and a half later, we are still every few weeks. But it wasn't that bad. I don't understand, it wasn't that bad. And between you and I, it really was.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, that's what we do. Mm. It's too big. We've protected ourselves by ignoring it.
Yeah. And yeah, it's so true. And actually a kind of good measure of it is like, would you wish it on your children? And if you wouldn't, then it's definitely worth dealing with. And actually, if we are talking about childhood trauma, you haven't got, at that point, you haven't got adult rational experience minds to be able to rationalize it. So of course it felt bad. You know, as we're saying, watching a sibling getting a present that you wanted feels bad. Losing your favourite teddy feels like a catastrophe. So, of course, if you get something that is the next level up, yeah, divorces, death, whatever, it genuinely is, in that tiny person's life, earth-shattering.
Totally. And I think that's been the amazing thing, working within trauma over the last 15 years, seeing this shift and all of us understanding that childhood trauma is very common. And I know that might that might frighten parents listening, but it is, because if you think of those things, so perceiving a threat, feeling overwhelmed, feeling out of control. If you zoom back to childhood and remember how it feels to be seven and how often you felt a bit threatened and out of control and overwhelmed, you can suddenly feel like, okay, this is something we actually all need to take seriously. Mm-hmm. It's not about the severity of the event. Oh, I shouldn't say that, because of course there are certain experiences that are so severe that almost all of us will have a traumatic reaction to them. But then there is this, these much more nuanced experiences, other T traumas, as I call them, that they're not going to affect everyone. Not everyone is going to perceive it as a threat. Mm-hmm. But if your kid does and then moves into overwhelm and feels really out of control, that's when you're potentially going to be dealing with a traumatic reaction. Mm-hmm. So recognizing what that looks like and not being afraid of it. I think that's a funny thing. People often say to me, God, it's so depressing. Aren't you so depressed working in trauma? What a depressing thing to have dedicated your life to. And I get that. I do get that if you stand back here, it doesn't look great. But when you work within the field, you know it's completely healable. Yes. It's completely fixable. You know, it really is. I stand here so hopeful, knowing that it can be okay. It is okay. It's always okay. You know, as we said, it just is. And the body wants to heal, but understanding how to help the nervous system regulate, rebalance, and discharge that traumatic energy is the journey, but it can be done.
And now a quick break to talk to you about a new jewellery brand called Ana Luisa. As you may or may not know, I live in a gold hoop. I think I started wearing them at the end of school, which by my calculations is 20 years ago. 20, how can that be? And I haven't deviated much since. I've always got at least one set of gold hoops, often several. So imagine my delight when I was introduced to Ana Luisa. That's A-N-A-L-U-I-S-A. As a new place to stock up on jewellery. It's at a pleasing price point too. It's nice enough to feel lovely to wear and to know that it'll stay in good nick, but not so pricey that you're afraid to wear it. Items start at about 35 quid. If you're in the market for some new bits, I've been living in a style called Venus, which are a mid-sized hoop. Also look at the Suzanne Huggies. It's what I've currently got in my second and third piercings. And that's not all. I've got a cheeky discount code for you too. Using ButY will get you 10% off. And there's a link in the show notes to make it even easier. The website is analuisa.com, A-N-A-L-U-I-S-A.com. I absolutely recommend them. Beautiful, sustainable jewellery, and there are lots of gold hoops.
Yeah, that's it. And the problem is, what we can do is, again, to make it personal, I spent so much energy trying to find coping strategies, trying to, you know, work my way through it. And that if I'd only have known earlier to put that energy into the healing, not the covering things up, it would have been a lot better. So if someone's listening and thinking this resonates, and as we're suggesting, it probably resonates with more people than it doesn't resonate with. Mm-hmm. And again, especially when you get to motherhood, I think that does throw all this stuff up, partly because you're on your back foot, all your resources are down, and makes you revisit your childhood. But what is the thing that people can begin to do to heal themselves?
I mean, what would I say? I think the first thing is to slow down. So if we come back to that point that I made, where we're trying to find that capacity to observe, the capacity to pull back and see, that's really the start point for me and anyone I'm working with. That's what we do, is, okay, well, what's going on? I don't need to see it. You need to be able to see it in the moment. So I think it's almost making yourself your new project. It's giving yourself permission to slow down and be curious. So that's the key word when you work in trauma. That's the word we use. Be curious about your reactions. Move towards them with, what is this? What am I doing? Why am I overreacting? Why am I suddenly feeling ashamed? If you can move towards them with curiosity, they'll continue to open up. Whereas the moment that you judge, you know, that comes from a place of fear, of course, so it all just closes down. And if anything, the reaction will become worse. So almost curious observation is the place to start.
And begin to see patterns, don't you? So, you might say, oh, I'm just an anxious person. What could happen is you begin to see that it's always a moment, probably when you feel a lack of control. However that manifests, you can begin to see the thread that comes through it.
Yeah, exactly. So you begin, if you can do this over a week, over 2 weeks, you will gently begin to see the patterns. Okay, I'm not always anxious, actually. Mm. When did I feel safe? Who was I with? What was I doing? Was I on my own? What were the kids doing? You know, it's just, it's beginning to pull things apart, because what we would do is as we heal you, and as your body, which you can do at home, what's happened is that over time, if we live with trauma, if we have a trauma history, our entire system has built itself around protecting you, as I said before, and finding threats. So you're basically only noticing the problems, the things that might go wrong, how crap you are, what you haven't done. And that is not you. So I know it might feel like it's you, but it's not you. That is a pattern of perception that has come directly from the trauma. So to heal, we have to begin looking over here. So it's really simple stuff is, you know, on a somatic level, it's sitting in the sun and really feeling it and trying to expand that good feeling. And even if you're in huge freeze response, huge collapse, huge freeze response or fight response, then I'll say to people, where's the safe place? Mm. Where in your body, where feels okay? Nowhere feels okay. I absolutely promise you, that's somewhere, even if it's just your butt cheek, somewhere feels okay. So we move to that space and then we expand it. So there may be odd examples, but I'm trying to explain that what we do is we're trying to just gently rebalance and widen. You're supposed to call it the window of tolerance. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of official somatic name for it, but I call it the lovely middle space, because it is, that's where we're trying to regulate back to. Mm-hmm. So you may be down here in freeze, you may be up here in fight flight at multiple times during the day. How can we move you back gently into this lovely middle space? Because what we're trying to do is create that rhythm again.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, your body can't naturally do it itself. So you're going up and staying up, or down and staying down. So we need to help your body find that rhythm again. And as you do, neuroplasticity takes over. Mm-hmm. And in a year or so, you won't need to try so hard.
No, because you're just reteaching yourself. Yeah.
That's it, reteaching the system, yeah.
And kind of, again, for me, having done CBT type therapy, I just needed to begin to prove to myself otherwise. So when my anxiety got the worst, I suddenly got this crippling fear of going on the tube from nowhere, which I now understand why. It's control. And it was terrible. And then I did a lot of CBT, and then I went skiing. I got stuck in a ski lift, which if this is your fear, I was like, well, now the worst possible thing has happened and I'm fine. I need to have proof points to myself. And as you say, you have to spot them in a day's parenting when you feel utterly out of control, but actually in the shower in the morning, you feel great. Like, even if it's this 3 minutes, there was a moment where I feel comfortable, and you just begin to loop those proof points back to yourself, don't you?
You do, exactly. And because I think so many of us, we do live in this very black and white, everything's awful, everything's okay. You often find, I mean, that's really, I'm using addiction speak there, but they're overlaid. You know, if you've got a trauma history, it's not that everyone's an addict, but trauma is all about kind of, you develop these habits, these pathways that become really deeply ingrained, which sounds a lot like addiction, doesn't it? So it's not necessarily, I'm not talking about substances, but what you find is that people become stuck. Mm-hmm. That's the word we use for trauma, isn't it? So they become stuck in these pathways and in these behaviors, these thoughts, these feelings, which is very addictive. We all become addicted to that space. Mm. It's very uncomfortable for people. If you're used to overthinking, and I dare to suggest to a client, how about we practice not doing that? It's so deeply wedded to who they are that it's so hard to separate from, and even suggest that they have a choice over it.
Yeah.
So what I'm trying to say is that so finding, even noticing that you had a nice time in the shower is so helpful, because we've been stuck over here. So what we need to do is help notice. You know, notice, when do I feel okay? And then, as you say, you can pull that into the day.
Yes.
Almost on a timer. Okay, well, now how can I do that? I haven't felt okay for an hour. What can I do to help my body feel safe?
And you're right, it begins to shape your entire perception. You know, you can have a day that is disastrous, or you can come back and say, well, there were a few challenging moments in that, but otherwise it was an all right day. But you set this dialogue for yourself otherwise, don't you? That, oh, all the bad things always happen to me, everything's a challenge, I'm having a terrible time. Yeah, and as you say, really, other than acute moments in your life, but even in the acute moments, you know, when people die, there are sometimes some magic moments in that. You've got to try and, yeah, remind yourself of the okay bits in everything.
You definitely do. It's such a good example. You know, even in grief, we can go and sit in the sun. Mm. We can feel sad and be okay. Mm. We can feel grief and be okay. You know, and that's such a beautiful, simple term, really, isn't it? Okayness is separate to feeling angry or sad or happy. Even it's just I'm okay.
I wonder whether we've all done ourselves a disservice by as well striving for these brilliantly perfect things all the time. And you know, again, the older you get, the more you do think, oh, I just want a bit of normality, a bit of average.
Oh, totally. Oh, Neil and I talk about that all the time, actually. Why we are so completely set on living in the fast lane. So we often use that analogy of like, why do we do it? So and then it gets too much. So we're up here, we're doing a lot, we're taking on projects, we're moving countries, mm-hmm. you know, whatever it might be. And then there's a moment where one of us is like, oh, no, too much, time out. This has just all got too much. And we come back into the middle lane. Mm. You know, and then we calm. But somehow... not somehow, it's trauma, it's patterning, yes. It's, you know, we always will move back up there. So we have to be very, very honest with ourselves and each other about that mechanism to move up. We're desperately trying to just stay in the middle lane at the moment.
Why, you know how we go. Why am I doing that kind of chomping at the bit thing to push things, to make things a bit more difficult? The moment you can kind of breathe, exactly. I put something else on my plate. And it's,
And Neil does it. We're just starting to settle. We've only been back in the country 6 months. We're in our house, which I love. I love my house. I've missed it. And he was like, oh, I found this great property to do up in the middle of the country. And I could feel my head about to explode. It's like, no, middle lane. Like, we do not need that. No. I get that it would be exciting. I get we might make money. I get it's creative. And, you know, that's all lovely, great stuff. But also there is such joy, health and sanity in keeping things small
and safe,
you know. So it's small and safe, yeah, and it's finding that balance, isn't it? Because obviously we all want to, you know, all those lovely things. We want to find, you know, find our purpose and live our purpose and create and, you know, and make the most of every day. But at the same time, as you say, I wonder if we've done the number on ourselves a little bit.
Yeah, and you're right. Maybe that is all this. It is all a bit of a trauma response. It's difficult because, as we've acknowledged, sometimes these things are useful. Sometimes whatever it is in me that makes me put my foot down has served me very well. And that's actually the weird thing with coping strategies. Like, hypervigilance has sorted me out on many, many occasions. It's been a linchpin to some of my success. So then that's why unpicking this can sometimes be quite difficult, because you have to accept coming back from that extreme behavior.
I love that. I think that's so true. I've been doing this amazing work recently with an internal family systems therapist. She's great. And we've been talking about exactly that. So the positive things that come from these kind of adaptations, mm-hmm. and how we need to show them respect, you know, because they've kept us alive or they've done a job. And she said, you really need to show them respect, because ultimately they're in charge, and it's only if they're on your side that they are going to play ball. And the moment you push against them, the moment you criticize, they're going to stick two fingers up and make life really hard.
Yeah, so it's saying, yep, I can see what you're doing now. You're beginning to try and control something. That's fine. Can you do it in a bit more of a gentle way, I think, is what I have to do, is like go, how can we gain control but not take all the air out of something so that it's utterly rigid?
Yeah, totally. It's just so important, because that to me is healing. Mm-hmm. You know, and standing in front of someone and saying you need to be radically different or completely different is the opposite of healing. It there has to be self-acceptance. Like that is the piece of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Accept who you are, accept all the little foibles. None of us are perfect. Just move, as I said before, you know, move towards things with curiosity, with self-compassion. And if you can, it's almost like that's enough. It's like you change your gaze and suddenly everything's okay and everything's manageable.
Mm. And similarly, as you're talking, I'm thinking I spent a long time wishing that some of the traumatic things happened to me hadn't happened. And then you just go, you cannot rewrite history. You cannot. What you can do is learn from it. And in particular, in the way that we try and parent. But there's a really difficult thing as a parent. We aren't going to keep our kids out of trauma. They will have, we can try our best, but living life is probably to experience some traumatic things.
Yeah, I mean, all of us experience the survival response. It's part of being human. We experience it multiple times a month, a week, you know, depending on our personality. It might even be more, not personality, but our kind of genetic makeup. So, of course, they will go into fight, flight, freeze. That may be coupled with overwhelm, and they might feel overwhelmed, and they may have a trauma response, and that's okay. You know, it's especially okay with kids. They're just so... resilient. You know, if you tool up on, you know, really begin to understand and educate yourself around what nervous system regulation is, what it looks like. You know, I was talking about that rhythm. That's really how you help kids heal trauma. They're stuck, so we need to help them find that rhythm again. It doesn't necessarily mean big deep conversations. In fact, with kids it often doesn't.
No.
It's about helping them by allowing them to express what they need to express, however they need to express it, and helping them learn to regulate, helping their bodies learn to regulate.
Yeah, and it's interesting as well, helping them feel what's going on. This is a bit different, but one of my kids doesn't get on very well with sugar, if I'm honest. You know, it makes him extremely angry. So I'm not going to ban sugar from him, but I have started saying to him afterwards, I just want you to acknowledge how you're feeling now, half an hour later. Is this a nice feeling for you? And maybe think about it next time. And similarly, it's like, oh, I can see that you're feeling overwhelmed. There's something that we can do about it. Why don't we get outside and go for a run? Why don't you get in the bath? And it's just giving them some of that dialogue around feelings and body sensations, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. And also trusting that it's all going in. Because I think that's a really important thing, because there's that incredible, like, awful dynamic, isn't it? Where that they won't admit, you know, or sometimes they do, of course, if they're in the right mood, but so often it's mum suggested it, so I'm definitely not going to do that. Mum thinks I should go for a run, so instead I'm going to sit here tapping my fingers.
Yeah, trying to get on a screen.
Exactly. But my experience of parenting and everything I've read about parenting and, you know, all of the parenting experts that I know would say the same thing, which is that you keep saying it and you model it. If you keep saying it and you model it, it's all going in and they will swing back round to it. And that has been my experience. I went past my son's room a while ago and he was doing polyvagal breathing. So he was doing the like voo breath. If I'd have gone in, he would have been phenomenally angry. And if I asked him about it, he would probably say, no, I never did that. I never listened to you, mum. Don't even really like you, mum. But it went in. You know, I'd been modelling it. So I do it when I'm in the kitchen, if I'm feeling a bit anxious. I've talked to him about it. And then there was a moment in which he tried it out. And that was like, yes, it's going in.
I'm doing something right.
Doing something right, oh, thank God.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly an equivalent of cleaning the teeth, you know. We can't clean their teeth forever, but what we can do is clean our teeth and try and get them to clean their teeth. And then at some point it's their gig, isn't it? And we have to hand it over. But it's really hard when you're deeply in parenting. And as we've acknowledged, it's a space which does throw up a lot of trauma to know whether you're doing the right thing. But when you occasionally ladder back, and again, I try and do this, look at my kids from afar and just be like, yeah, I might not be the best parent, but fundamentally something is going okay.
Something's going okay. I agree with that. I totally agree. And it is important. It is so important just to stand back. And because I think, well, and I suppose one thing we haven't spoken about really is how triggering parenting can be. you know, that's been a major issue for me over the last 3 years, is I had done a piece of trauma work around something. I thought I'd done my trauma work around something. Something happened with one of my kids and it triggered me. Oh my goodness. It actually re-traumatized me. It was awful. And that came from day-to-day parenting. So one of my old traumas popped up, greatly impacted my kids, my family, my health, my recovery. And that's why we all need to look at this stuff. Mm. Because if, you know, and if anyone listening is, you're having a huge reaction to something that's going on in your kids' lives, mm-hmm. I would really, really, really urge you to lovingly just consider the idea that you might be being triggered, mm-hmm. i.e. it might be reminding your subconscious, your body, of something that happened to you when you were a kid, or around you when you mm-hmm. were a kid. You know, it wasn't necessarily even directly with you. And that's where the reaction's coming from.
It's
important.
I was going to ask you what the one piece of advice is, but I think that is the perfect one piece of advice, that we do, I think, in ourselves know if our reaction is disproportionate to what we're seeing. I think you can usually get there, but just also not just to accept that this is the way it has to be. I think that is mm-hmm. such a false narrative. You know, oh, you know, I've got to this age, this is me now. It's a bit rubbish, but I'll soldier on. There really can be a different way, and you can begin to see positive changes quite quickly. It might not be the healing work, but it's things can feel better, can't they?
Oh, definitely. I'm working with one guy, and he is 75, and I respect him so much. I respect him so much. It makes me feel really emotional when I say that, because I'm a bit lost for words, but I respect him, you know, and his self-respect and desire to heal, you know. And I would say to anyone, if he can do it, you can do it. And it is never, ever, ever too late. And especially in the sphere of parenting, you know, even if your kids are 30, if you do your work, or 40 or whatever, you know, if you do your work and change that dynamic, you will transform your relationship and yourself.
Yeah, and transform your life. Mm. Yeah, I mean, good on him. And it's such a gift of self-love is really banded around so much, but it's a gift of reparenting yourself, isn't it? And having enough, this is a problem, sometimes seeking help, you have to have enough of a sense of self-worth to know that you deserve it, which is why it becomes complicated. But everybody deserves to feel closer to being healed.
Everybody deserves to feel okay. Absolutely. And I think, and it's that, you know, it's interesting, isn't it, what sparks that, like you say, because it's really hard, because I think so many people don't think they deserve help, or they think they're beyond help, which I suppose is kind of linked together. Mm-hmm. So that chink of light, that doorway, I'm so interested in what that is. You know, how can we communicate to people? I know it can be okay. I know it will be okay. Mm-hmm. I know you'll heal. I know you'll be okay. I know you can even thrive, you know, after trauma, after some really dark stuff. I see it all the time. Not because these people are more resilient than whoever might be listening to this, needing to hear it, but because they just took the step. Mm-hmm. They made the call. You know, there was something in them that got them to cross the line. Mm-hmm. And that's, if we could figure that out, Clemmie, we'd be able to help so many people, because they're the people I want to cross the line. I want them to call. Just, you know, I want them to email after this and just say, all right, then, what's this about? I had a great email actually from someone in Australia. I think it was last week. It was a guy who said, I'm enjoying your book. I think your book's great. I really appreciate you writing it. And I'm really intrigued. But just so you know, I don't think you can heal from trauma. Any thoughts?
Oh. Well,
I really appreciate him getting in touch, you know, because essentially what he's saying is, I've been really hurt and my experiences haven't been great with healing. What now? So he's crossed the line. You know, he's given me an opportunity to say, okay, what have you done so far? What about this? You know, the fact that he emailed is the door.
That's what I was about to say. Even by saying that, you know, that's exactly like me going, you can't rewrite history. right, accept that. Not to say that you accept the consequences or that it, and you don't need to say it was okay, but it, that is actually sometimes a bit of the solid ground that becomes your starting point to move towards something. So I think he's created his own in resisting the idea of your book. He's started on his journey, I think.
Exactly. That's exactly what I mean. However he's done it in whatever language, yeah, with whatever energy attached to it, he sent the email.
Yeah.
So that is, you know, he's moved into it, exactly, which is amazing. Whatever works.
Not just as a shameless promo, but your book is a, if you know, if you don't want to go into therapy or that doesn't feel like the next step, your book is a way of beginning to explore this and see if anything resonates.
Yeah, absolutely. And the reason I wrote the book is because my experience of most books about trauma, not all of them, but the vast majority, is that they're really, really heavy and can be. And if they're not really, really heavy, they're heavy because they're very scientific. So they're just, I just didn't find them very accessible. Mm-hmm. You know, I really didn't. And so the main thing I wanted to do as I wrote the book was write in a way that just felt really accessible to people, easy to read. And I think I've achieved it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm really pleased with that. And some people say, oh gosh, it was just so easy to read, as if it was a bad thing. And I think, yes, you know, I wanted people to be able to just devour it, just start to finish. And yeah, so it's, although it's not the comfiest of subject matters, I would say that I've written about it in such a way that allows you to feel as comfortable as you're going to get with this topic.
Yeah. It's very gentle. It really is gentle. Because as we joked at the beginning, it's not, you know, it's been my bedtime reading for the last couple of days. But I don't find it overwhelming at all. I just find it very human and very gentle.
Great. Oh, it's good feedback.
Two things before we go. Number one, where can people find you, please?
Where can people? I'm everywhere, really. So where am I? So my website is www.sarahwoodhouse.com, and Instagram and Facebook, I'm at the Sarah Woodhouse, and on Twitter, I'm at SN_Woodhouse.
There you go. You can find her in those places.
Find me there. Yeah.
Yeah. And you haven't you just launched a program? What is it? Haven't you just launched something that?
I've just launched a program.
Give that a little plug.
Oh, it's so great. I'll happily give it a plug because it's just going so well. It's called The Freedom Process. And I've got the first cohort moving through it at the moment. So I've got about 25, 27 women moving through it. And it's all designed to help you regulate your nervous system. So there's a lot of somatic work in there, but also help you do your trauma work in a really gentle way. So it's somatic exercises alongside kind of written work, really. And then there's some group stuff as well. But I'm so proud of it.
Well done.
And it's working well. People are responding really well.
So what are you, a week into that? A couple of weeks into?
We are 3 weeks in.
Oh, okay. So it's kind of finding its feet now.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
How long has that been in your head for?
2 years. Yeah. 2 years. So I think my giddiness, aside from anything, is, and you must know what this feels like. It's when you have an idea and then suddenly it's out there. It's bizarre.
It's happening.
And incredible. It's happening. It's just happening. This thing I've talked about and worked about and squirreled my way, you know, different research papers. And could I add this? And should I add that? Suddenly it's there and you can see all the bits weaving together.
Yeah.
It's the loveliest feeling, isn't it?
And your brain goes into a very different space because now you can begin to figure it out based on reality rather than trying to hold in your head an imagined version of something is so hard.
Yeah, thanks for saying that. I didn't, because the only prior experience I've had of that was the book, and it's obviously quite different because you've got the draft there. It's just not at all the same. And this is the first time I've launched something like this. So yeah, that's what I've been doing. I've had 2 years of imagining, and it's so much easier now. It's up and running to tweak, and so now I really get the whole thing of just do it.
Yeah.
Now I get it when people are like, just start, just start it, and I don't think I'd understood the value of that until this course.
So well done. You got to wonder whether like some of the difficult time you've had recently has been the nudge, you know, with Australia has been the nudge to this. So
I'm sure it has. Sure that it has. Exactly.
It all works out. My last question is, if you could have an honest conversation with one person, who would it be and what would you say?
Oh, can I just say exactly who popped into my head?
Yeah.
Oh, no, I'd always mess these up. I should say someone.
No.
No,
do the unedited one because it's best.
Do the unedited one. Okay. Weirdly, I'm totally obsessed with Scientology. I'm not a Scientologist. My main genre of documentary is ones about weird cults.
Really?
I am just so fascinated. Maybe in a past life, yeah, I was in a weird cult. I don't know. I'm fascinated in it. So I would have an hour with Tom Cruise and ask him all about Scientology.
That's a great one.
So I do.
I don't know whether the intrigue for me about cults is because, like with any of the extremities of life, it's that I always feel like I could end up in a different way, in a different time. You could end up there, you know.
Totally. Because I've had my moments. Mm. I've never been on the verge of joining a cult, but I've definitely, you know, I've done the ashram thing. I've done this.
Yeah.
So I think, and my spirituality is really important to me. So anything that's kind of gone next level with that, I'm just fascinated by it. And we all could, exactly, I'm sure.
Yeah, and you know, on the one hand, I'm sure these things are really alien, but there'll be things in the middle of it that we can relate to. It's shared values, shared ideas, shared passions, and then they tend to get extreme. Well, I wasn't expecting you to answer that. What a fantastic answer. Who knew?
I didn't before I said it.
You definitely can't edit those answers though, because that is like the truest one. I realised that you never told me what your favourite crisp was either, and it'll bug me if I don't know.
Oh, my favourite crisp. I'm going to go old school and say a hula hoop.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Putting them on your fingers.
Yeah, brilliant. Ready salted ones. Or
ready salted, yeah. Just ready salted, yeah. Straight down the line.
Yeah, they're quite hard. But maybe that's
they
just
are
showing,
quite hard.
Showing that.
What's
a bit
your
up.
What's your favourite?
I mean, ready salted Walkers, probably.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Another classic.
Yeah. I mean, most crisps are pretty good.
Are they your genre of food?
Yeah. Yeah. Reliably good. But yeah, uncomplicated. Not things like Pom Bears now, which make me shudder because they smell of salted, like the early parenting days. Well, I've got a few feelings going on now. Number one, it's very, very nice to see Sarah's face. Yeah, I think we might have last seen each other either outside the school gates or in Bar Med, which is where I spent a long time drinking watermelon Bacardi Breezes. That was my tipple of choice at that time. But aside from that, I found it really fascinating to unpick trauma, in particular to get your head around the fact that this is in the foundations of many of us and how we go about things, and that trauma doesn't have to be on a sliding scale. It's about how it shows up in your body. And more importantly, that it's something that can be healed or in part be healed, and that we don't need to let it continue to shape our lives. Sarah's book really is brilliant, and it's a great starting point to begin to unpick it and to understand where and how that might be showing up, because it might not be the places you expect. So I really do recommend it. And that's a wrap. Thank you to Sarah for being my guest, and for you guys for listening. As ever, I'm always keen to hear from you. The email is butwhy@clemmytelford, and rate and review and share the episode. That makes a huge difference to trying to get it in more people's ears. I am now off to try and get some sunshine. I can see it shining through the window, so I'm going to have my lunch outside, try and get a bit of vitamin D. Wishing you a lovely day, and catch up with you next time. Bye bye.